I love the sound of breaking glass. J'espère que vous êtes bien à notre écoute. Notre lunchtime en anglais continue avec la chronique Breaking Glass de Dennis Bro. I need the noises of destruction.
This is Broke on the Global Literary Beat, Breaking Glass. Today's episode features my novel, The Precinct with the Golden Arm. This is the third novel in Calamitous Corruption, the Harry Palmer L.A. trilogy, and this one, set in 1949 in Babylon, L.A., is about the LAPD, Big Pharma, and the Mexican-American, currently gentrifying community of Boyle Heights. In this chapter, Harry, an ex-cop, is on the trail of a potentially corrupt officer who also may be in cahoots with what is becoming in 1949 a new-look Ku Klux Klan. He's just been given by a Mexican policewoman a tip of some suspicious doings by the cop Higgins. I resolved to tail him and find out what he was up to. No easy feat to track a professional who often made his living following others. I had to be careful. The first thing was to disguise myself in my car. He knew me, and though he didn't know what I drove, the piece of junk I put on the highway was very noticeable, so I decided to rent a car for this exercise. The most popular car at the moment was the Ford Tudor sedan, way too big for me alone, but likely to confuse anyone suspecting a tail because so many were on the road. It was easy to rent one since they were all over the lot. Then I needed to disguise myself in case Higgins picked me up behind him. I almost always wore gray suits and a mauve tie or a brown trench coat, sometimes with a matching fedora. Instead, I wore an open white shirt with a white Panama hat that I pulled down almost over my eyes. He might pick up that I was behind him, but he wouldn't be able to tell who I was. I swung by the station that evening. I thought he would be off by 7 or so, I guessed correctly. Higgins, in plain clothes, blue shirt and slacks, which almost made him look human, came out of the station and went around the corner to his car, a gray Pontiac sedan that looked recent. He was going in style. I wondered where the money to buy this was coming from on his sergeant's salary. We headed east, Higgins and I, first through some towns with Spanish names and mixed populations, El Monte, Covina, Pomona, but then gradually through towns to where only whites need apply, as we moved into the Inland Empire, through San Bernardino County and then dipped sharply into Big Bear Valley. Finally, after almost an hour, we stopped in Fontana, a town of white picket fences, white houses, white businesses, and streets entirely populated by white residents. It seemed like everyone was packing into a car, with the kids especially jamming the main drag with roadsters. We drove past Angel's Court, and then Higgins pulled into a parking lot near Valley Forge Court. Very patriotic, I noted. The lot was nearly full. He drove right to the front, where a few spaces were left, and pulled his outsized vehicle into what amounted to 2 spaces. I watched him get out and saunter to the edge of the parking space. He walked across the lawn and went down the steps of a church into its basement. He didn't seem to be a particularly religious man, so my suspicions were aroused. I had to get in there. In my white attire, which I thought was perfect for this town, I approached the church. Outside were a few men, probably in their 40s or older, smoking and hesitating before going in. They looked at me with suspicion, but when I asked if I was on time for the meeting, they seemed to relax. I watched at the bottom of the stairs as each man, and they were all men, entered with what looked like a secret handshake, which was just fingers connected, a hand on top and bottom, and finishing by bumping fists. If that was all that was needed to enter, this must be the dumbest secret society that ever existed. Inside, my impression was confirmed. Hanging from the rafters were 3 banners, a U.S. flag, a Confederate flag, and a flag with a burning cross. A podium with a few men seated behind stood on a raised platform in the front. Higgins sat in the front row. I took a seat in the back. A speaker was approaching the podium when a shuffle occurred in the back entrance. 2 men in white hoods were attempting to gain access. The speaker, over a microphone, ordered them to remove the hoods and take their place inside. He seemed somewhat embarrassed and agitated at having to enforce the no sheets, no hoods dress code. The speaker introduced himself not by name, but as the Imperial Wizard. Besides the fancy name, he seemed very modern in white shirt and tan slacks, and looking very relaxed at the podium. "Welcome," he said, "to the new clan, sans hoods and robes. Our organization has been outlawed by the California Attorney General, but we're still here. Only now, we're not so obvious." Some groans of discontent rose from the audience of predominantly balding and semi-balding white men, who apparently were still yearning for the good old days, which were neither good nor old. The Klan had been very active in the year after the war, particularly in Los Angeles, attempting especially to keep Negro residents in their place. If any Negro had tried to move into a white area, they would find a burning cross on their lawn soon after they arrived. The same went for Jews, where at USC, a Jewish fraternity found a cross burning on their lawn. And the harassment didn't stop with warnings. Just before I quit the force, the brother of a man who challenged a restrictive covenant was found beaten unconscious in an alley. "We survived because we have the support of the community in our work. The police investigated us and said our actions were nothing more than childish pranks. Even the mayor of L.A. defended our work, telling the un-American NAACP, with that dreaded name, everyone booed, that we can't investigate people just because they're prejudiced, since you people are prejudiced against the Klan. In all the time since our organization has been declared illegal, not a single arrest has been made." Everyone cheered. Higgins raised his fist and joined in the lusty yell. "Nevertheless, we're looking to work in a different way now, trying to use city councilmen and civic leaders to get what we want and to keep Negroes in their place. They're already talking about discontinuing the L.A. red streetcars, which carry the Negroes to their jobs in the factories, and they're being pushed into Watts, where we hope they stay." More cheers. "So we're making real progress in maintaining the color line, which is better for both us and them." I'd heard this rationale before on the force, how keeping all others except the white Anglo race down and in substandard housing and jobs was actually doing them a favor, and they should be grateful for it. It was the kind of twisted logic that only those on top could come up with. "Tonight, though, we're not here to talk about the Negro threat to our homes and our homeland, but rather another grave threat, which we will have to contend with, and that's the Mexican menace." "Let's get those wetbacks," somebody yelled. But the wizard, in his imperial graciousness, waved off the demand, smiled, and went on. "Can you imagine," he said, "the white race being overrun by a class of people of the mentality of the Mexicans? For a long time, we thought they were just lazy and stupid and never posed a threat. But now we realize they formed into gangs, and they can be vicious and treacherous. We're afraid that if they continue to come over the border and fill up Los Angeles with their large families, they keep getting larger, and then move out from there, we could have a race problem in California that will dwarf the Negro problem in the South. Worst of all, is when the Mexicans mix with Jews, with Negroes, with Japanese, and even with some Irish and Italians, all being led by the communists in an attack on our way of life. Cries of, down with the Pinkos," our fearless leader continued. "I'm speaking about Boyle Heights in L.A., perhaps the most dangerous community in America. It's like Ellis Island West, filled with all kinds of dirty refugees. They all live together in the same public housing complexes, a communist plot if ever there was one, and something must be done. But," he said, "we're the new Klan, and instead of burning crosses, we're working in a different way, and the city and the state are supporting us. The first thing is the banks are refusing loans to any of these residents who try to leave the Heights and the other Mexican neighborhoods of East L.A. The last thing we need is these people out here. So we're working with financial institutions to help identify potential borrowers from those communities." The crowd didn't know what to make of this. They seemed as a group to be much in favor of burning crosses and beating up people, little accustomed to the finer points of segregation. But then the whiz gave them all something to cheer about. "The other project in which we're working with the state is in dividing the neighborhood by running state highways through it, which will serve a twofold purpose." His Imperial Majesty was starting to sound like a city planner himself. "First, by claiming land from the community to build these new freeways and dividing them up, so you won't be able to walk more than a few blocks without encountering an underpass. Then, because some of us work in L.A. or go in on our off hours, the freeways will allow us to drive straight through and over these wretched lands without ever having to see anyone living in them." More cheers. The men, many of them overweight, cheered again. Some of them bounced their bellies. I'd been in a lot of scary situations, but none with this combination of horror and ridiculousness. "We still have to be vigilant because by rights we are outlawed, And we need to make sure that we have our hands on the pulse of the city police and the sheriff's office. To that end, I would like to introduce our man on the force, Sam Chase. Who should then rise but Higgins, who spoke from the audience in front of the podium with the wizard above him cheering him on. "I joined the auxiliary police," Chase said, "to keep an eye on what goes on in the force. But I need some of you to help me. I'm going to go through the audience and point out a couple of you who I'm asking to volunteer to train to be auxiliary police, just like junior G-men, and help me keep tabs." When the meeting broke up, eager volunteers swarmed Higgins. I made lickety-split for the exit. Higgins was up to something, all right. I didn't know quite what, but I was more than shocked at the way the Klan was working with and probably infiltrating banks, state planning offices, and the police. Why burn a cross when you can refuse a loan? Why attack neighborhoods when you can segment and divide them? And why fear the police when you're part of them? This is Bro on the Global Literary Beat with my novel, The Precinct with the Golden Arm.
Dennis Bro is the author of Film Noir, American Workers and Postwar Hollywood, Class Crime and International Film Noir, and Maverick or How the West Was Lost. Is Hyper-Industrialism and Television Seriality, The End of Leisure and the Birth of the Binge. C'était Breaking Glass de Dennis Bro sur Art District. Très bonne suite de nos programmes, jazzistiques et artistiques, à notre écoute. Sound of Breaking Glass.